This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The House failed to pass the latest immigration legislation this week. Not a single Democrat voted for the measure, and even Republicans resoundingly voted no. The lack of support could be attributed to Donald Trump's mixed messages. Last week, he told his party not to bother passing anything. This week, he gave a last-minute endorsement to a measure that could have helped resolve the issue of parents and children being separated at the border. Joining us to get a little deeper into this immigration question are two attorneys who work with the immigrant community on a daily basis. Heather Scavone is director of the Humanitarian Immigration Law Clinic at Elon University and a professor of law. Heather, welcome. Good to have you here.
Great to be here.
Also with us is Jessica Yanez. She is an immigration attorney who runs her own practice in Greensboro. Jessica, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
We talked about how quickly and how often these so-called policy, I mean, it's not even a policy anymore because we can't keep up. You're trying to do this for a living. What's it like for you trying to keep
Correct.
Up?
Correct. I've worked in the field over a decade now, and as I let one client know, it's even hard for those of us who do this 100% of the time to keep up with the rapidly changing policies. I've made a joke a time or two that when I go out on my lunch break, a policy will probably change before we get back. The policy has changed just this morning on a number of issues. So when there aren't direct policies that are carried out thoughtfully, there are a lot of unintended consequences that affect the immigrants who are going through the system.
Well, the president's hearing from his own agencies who are going to the White House saying, well, what should we do? We're confused. And a border, a national border is a bad place to have your agencies in confusion.
Exactly. So what's happening is they will announce a policy without thinking it through and without consulting the agencies that are designed to implement these policies. And we've seen that from the border. From the Customs and Border Patrol to ICE, who are the local and national agents that are implementing these policies, as well as the immigration courts across the country.
Heather, in the past, someone caught at the border would be detained. They would get a hearing if they were claiming asylum or the need for asylum. What does this zero policy do, and how did it get started? Because maybe there's some confusion over what rights you have. You do have the right to due process if you're any human being on American soil.
Right. So I think what's interesting about the zero tolerance policy is it's this idea that we have a criminal law for unlawful entry, and the administration is saying we have to enforce that all the time. So we've got to follow the law, and that's what they're doing. However, it's interesting that the administration claiming its biggest goal is to enforce the laws, it's not enforcing all laws. So in addition to that unlawful entry law, we have laws such as our asylum law that says that individuals are allowed to seek asylum regardless of the manner of their entry. We have the UN Refugee Convention, which tells us that we shouldn't punish asylum seekers based on coming in without permission or being here without permission. And so it's really a selective enforcement. It's not actually enforcing all of the laws, which is what you would hope our administration would do.
You would talk about the asylum and the fact that there is, you do get your day in court if you're seeking asylum. But right now, we're talking about a backlog of something like 700,000 cases. I mean, how do we even manage that? If we were to say, let's allow due process, what would that mean, practically speaking, if we were actually to try to get through that caseload?
Yeah, so I think that's a great question. And what you have is kind of a really evident bottleneck. If you've ramped up CBP or the enforcement people at the border, so they're apprehending more people, putting more people into deportation proceedings, but you're not having an equal increase in the number of immigration judges, then the bottleneck is just going to get worse and worse. And so, for example, in 2015, I was at the border working in a family detention facility representing Central American mothers and children. And a case that we took on in March of 2015 has its next court date set for November of 2019.
Wow.
So the backlog is only getting worse.
But Jessica, you're saying that immigrants at this point, there would be a date 5 years hence or 4 years hence, and it would be on a calendar. You're saying that at this point, it looks like some immigrants are not going to see their day in court.
That's correct. I would just say that the zero tolerance policy is really a zero thought policy. And what the administration has done is stripped all discretion from immigration officers, and they're leaning towards stripping any type of discretion from the judges themselves. The Department of Justice now has a proposal to prevent people who arrive at the border from seeking asylum at all. It would simply be to arrest and deport without having their day in court.
Well, look, here's what the administration is saying. Look, you've got these a number of people, a huge number of people, many of whom would not be a national security threat. But given these numbers, it would be easy to slip someone with malicious intent into that group. We have to do something. We have laws. And it is the primary responsibility of the president of the United States to protect our national borders. So he's clamping down, trying to protect our safety.
I think that we can do both. I think that we can protect the borders, and I think that we can ensure that people have their rights. And I think it's easy for people that aren't familiar with immigrants to not understand what's going on. I had a colleague from law school call me last week and said, look, I don't know any immigrants. I don't know anything about this, but my office wants to help. They do real estate and something completely different. She said, I just have no frame of reference. So when we look at people and we label them as they are illegal and we somehow make them less than, it seems to make people have a little bit less empathy. But I will say that the border is not the only place where we're seeing these policies carried out thoughtlessly. That U.S. citizen children are also being stripped away from their parents due to the interior enforcement policies.
How does that work? Explain that.
So what we've seen in the past year and a half, prior to this administration, there was a set of priorities, and it makes sense to prioritize, just as a police officer would prioritize a drug dealer or someone who's committed a violent crime over someone who's committed a traffic violation, it makes sense for us to prioritize immigration the same way. It was a little bit easier to operate under those guidelines. Now all of that discretion and prioritization has been stripped away. So what we've seen in the past year and a half at our office and throughout the country is people that have no criminal records, that have been in the country for sometimes decades, that are gainfully employed. One recently who was a youth pastor at a church who was picked up because ICE was looking for the wrong person and said, hey, you happen to be here, not the person that we were looking for, but we've got to meet our quotas. So when you have that pressure on the ICE officers to detain as many people as possible and the pressure on the judge to deport as many people as possible, you've set up a factory for deportations.
But you also talk about citizens, children who are citizens being taken.
Correct. A lot of those people that are residing here have children that are U.S. citizens. One thing that sticks out in my mind is for a young girl who is suffering from a severe disability that affects about 1 in 30,000 people. She's 4 years old and her father was detained. And as she left our office that day, she said, please don't let them take my mom too. And I stopped and I thought, I can't guarantee to that child that they wouldn't take her mom away. So we do the best that we can with what we're given. But I think everybody would agree, whether it's a government attorney or the immigration judge or the immigration advocate, that the system needs to be overhauled. And the way that this administration is implementing these policies is not the way to go about it.
Heather, we saw the national outrage over stripping children from their families, Republicans and Democrats both outraged at the brutality of that. The Trump administration was for a while doubling down, but finally had to back down. But you're saying that there's a way in which those children who have been separated already may not make it back to their families.
Yeah, I think that when you look at the possible outcomes for children who've already been separated, initially they go into the custody of the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is a federal agency. But if they don't have a relative in the U.S. with whom they can be connected who's not, you know, in federal detention, then they may go into the foster care system of local departments of social services, you know, for example, Guilford County, Orange County. Once that happens, it becomes difficult, if not impossible, for the parent to get them back. You could imagine a parent being ordered deported, and the child is now in the custody of social services in Guilford County. The parent from outside of the United States would need to retain an attorney in Guilford County to represent them in the proceedings for, you know, juvenile dependency neglect in order to get their parental rights, acknowledged. So some parents will permanently lose their children as a result of this, and it will also put a large burden potentially on local, you know, and regional taxpayers who are paying into this DSS system.
Well, there's another ironic and sort of dreadful paradox in all of this, in that if there were a case like this, the local Child Protective Services, the county agencies, and the courts are always looking out for the best interest of the child. So you might imagine that if the claim of the parent were true, we're living in mortal danger in our native country. That's why we're coming here for asylum. The courts might agree and say, we're not going to send that child back into the mortal danger. which your mother didn't have a fair hearing to be adjudicated, and for which she may have been granted asylum, but we didn't do that.
Yeah, you just nailed it. At that point, it's the county deciding what is the best interest of the child. And evidently, it's not going to be in the best interest of the child to send them back to a place where they might or would certainly be harmed.
What about that? The idea that we know we have a everybody, according to our Constitution, if you're on American soil, has a right to due process, but that doesn't give you the full rights of U.S. citizenship. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but that's how I understand when we talk about the rights and due process for people who are being detained, seeking asylum. There's a right to due process, but not the full rights of citizenship, right? Which is to say, not necessarily the right to free representation.
Correct. That due process is the starting point. So that means that someone is entitled to have their day in court. That doesn't mean that their cases will be approved. So I think that's what I want everybody to realize, is that even after these families are reunited, for those who will be reunited, we're just at the very beginning of a long, drawn-out process. Their cases will be assigned to immigration judges around the country. And in North and South Carolina, that's Charlotte Immigration Court. They will be required to appear before the judge and given time to retain counsel. North Carolina has an amazing group of immigration attorneys here, but we do not have the number of nonprofits that can offer pro bono assistance. So you have people that have just fled to the United States with the clothes on their back who are unable to obtain the legal representation that they need. Once the process moves forward a bit, they will be given a hearing. And at that time, they have to establish eligibility for asylum. And it's very difficult to meet that standard, and even more difficult given the recent decision by Sessions to look at the asylum laws and rewrite the requirements about who will and will not qualify. It's obvious they're coming at this from all angles to try to cut this possibility off almost entirely.
Well, Heather, tell us more about that, about this, because asylum seekers had for a while been granted asylum under the law, claiming a spousal abuse, and it wasn't clear that the law intended that when you talk about political violence or political oppression, that domestic violence was included. Jeff Sessions has taken a very narrow view of that and said we're not going to include. But maybe you can explain that for us, because I think one of these cases came from a case that was originally handled in Charlotte, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So the matter of AB, which Jeff Sessions certified to himself and decided a couple weeks ago, really has much broader reaching consequences even than just the domestic violence-based asylum cases. It essentially restated things in the law that we already knew were there, but has taken an approach that in cases where you have a non-government persecutor, so for example, a domestic violence case, where it's some type of private crime, that it's going to be much harder for individuals to get asylum. And so yes, that impacts domestic violence cases where you might have a spouse or some other relative who's the perpetrator. But you can actually see how, imagine for LGBTQI asylum applicants, maybe homophobic mob violence is prevalent in a country, but it's not being perpetrated by the actual government. And now that case is compromised. Or you think about female genital mutilation cases where it may be a tribal group that's practicing this harmful practice and not the government itself. And so even though the case that Sessions decided does impact domestic violence cases a lot, it could seep out into a lot of other well settled areas of asylum law.
One of the arguments that Sessions has made is that the law really never did intend and was actually creatively expanded to include the victims of domestic violence, but it was really intended for those who are facing political persecution for their ideological and political beliefs, and had been expanded for humanitarian reasons, but the law really never was intended for those individuals.
Yeah, I mean, if I could, I think that an analogy that we can bring to this situation, because what he's saying is the same thing that everyone said after World War II, which is, you know, this refugee convention, it can't encompass all kinds of different things. Back in World War II, we didn't necessarily contemplate gay and lesbian individuals who were persecuted during the Holocaust. We didn't specifically contemplate them, but in fact, that protection was necessary and is squarely provided for under the Refugee Convention and then our domestic law that's identical to the Refugee Convention. And at the times, we heard the same floodgate argument, which was, we can't possibly let all Jewish people come here. We don't have the resources. Well, what we saw is it wasn't all Jewish people that came here. We weren't overrun by Jewish refugees from World War II. It was only people who later, when our own refugee laws were codified, could meet all the requirements. And the same is true with these Central American cases. It wouldn't be all women who get to come to the United States under a domestic violence protection for asylum. It's just those who meet every other element of the statute.
Jessica, what about the, you know, we're talking about zero tolerance and the effect that it's had and the backlog of cases as well. In terms of trying to keep these cases open, we've seen a change in that. And this is another case in which Jeff Sessions weighed in and offered an opinion, which has changed the way the policy is going to be carried out. Explain what it means about keeping a case open or closing a case and how his decision there may affect immigrants.
So I think the easiest way to look at it for somebody that doesn't have any experience with our system is if we get a speeding ticket. So a police officer will hand you the speeding ticket, and then you'll go into court, and the DA will tell you, if you'll go complete this class, we'll go ahead and reduce this ticket. I'm going to give you a few months to get that done. You complete the class, you get back to court, and your case is either dismissed or they've reduced your charge. What happens in immigration court is that the immigration judges are only allowed to adjudicate certain types of cases. Then you have the Immigration Service, USCIS, the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service, that processes the actual applications and the cases that people need in order to obtain lawful status. So if the judges are required to work under an unreasonable caseload and we're telling them you must adjudicate this number of cases every single day, don't give people time to get that. It really contradicts the fact that we want people to do things the right way and to get in line because we're preventing them from doing them the right way and actually getting in line. Another example would be for people that are they're married to a U.S. citizen. They may have had a previous immigration case or they have a prior order. And now they're filing their paperwork to actually get their green card, to get everything straightened out. And at the time they go to their interview to establish that they have a valid marriage, they're detained on the spot. We saw that recently with the case for a woman who was detained on the spot, who was just deported on Monday, who's married to a U.S. citizen and has a six-year-old U.S. citizen child. So that's what I mean when these policies go beyond the border. It's happening nationwide. And I think that if the government's mission is to protect the United States, that we're failing United States citizens who are family members of immigrants by not giving them the opportunity or their due process rights to have their day in court.
What about the argument itself? And also, I suppose we should talk about sort of who benefits from this. The fact is these detention camps, many of them are privately owned and they're expanding. They have some guarantees. I mean, talk about, Heather, how this is organized and who's actually benefiting from this crisis and chaos.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think so. Immigration detention, it's really become evident that it's driven by profit and politics and not by national security or public safety concerns. There are two private prison for-profit companies that have cornered the market on civil immigrant detention, Geo Group and Core Civic. And in both cases, they're able to detain immigrants. It's about $400 a night for immigrants in family detention. It's a little less than that for adults where it's not children in detention as well. So the cost is exorbitant. That cost is paid for by the U.S. taxpayer. And these prison companies are able to profit exorbitantly from the detention. This despite the fact that we have alternatives to detention that are really cheap and super effective.
Well, like what? Because the fear is that if I let you go, obviously you've already taken the risk of breaking law and entering illegally. Why would you come back for your hearing?
Right. And despite that, so DHS, so Homeland Security, just in its current fiscal year budget estimate, decided that it would cost roughly $4.50 a day to use a lot of the alternatives to detention. So there are a self-reporting process where individuals are released on their own recognizance and have to check in with ICE. There are ankle bracelets. Individuals could be released on a small bond. And that by their own statistics, 97% of people report and don't abscond. So the reason that we're paying $400 a night is not evident, except that there's this very powerful private prison lobby, and Congress has actually legislated the number of immigrant bodies that must be detained in facilities every night, which is a sweet deal. You can't imagine like a private hotel having that deal with the government.
Yeah, that would be great.
Unless the hotel
was maybe owned by the president. Who knows?
Right, right.
That's how I describe it to my clients. The hotel needs to stay full. So,
yeah.
Jessica Yanez is an immigration attorney and founder founder of Yanya's Immigration Law in Greensboro, Heather Scavone, director of the Humanitarian Immigration Law Clinic at Elon University. Heather's going to present a forum called Shifting Worlds at August 24th at Alumni House at the campus of UNCG. And you can find out all about that at our website, stateofthings.org. Live music coming up in just a minute. Stay tuned.